There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. Literary Spotlight.
For Literary Spotlight today, we're going to be chatting about three very different authors writing about India and appearing from the 1st to the 10th of March at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. Joining us for this discussion is Riz Khan, international journalist, author and public speaker. He is known worldwide for his flagship TV shows on CNN International and Al Jazeera English, of which he was a founding director. Not only did Riz launch the first global live interactive talk show Q&A with Riz Khan, but through the span of his career, he has conducted more than 10,000 interviews. No pressure, eh, Rachel?
Wow.
The first book that we're looking at as part of the Literary Spotlight and the first author, Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India, is by an author appearing at the Literature Festival in March, as I mentioned, Shashi Tharoor. You've met Shashi, haven't you, Riz?
I have, and thank you for having me on the show, Annabelle and Rachel. Hi. Actually, it's very nostalgic to be back in a radio studio because I started out at BBC Radio. So that's what I actually trained in radio journalism specifically, so it's quite nice to be back here. Yeah, it's funny, actually. Shashi is someone I, as a journalist, I interviewed when he was still at the UN. He had quite a prominent role there. In fact, he was pegged to be Secretary General. But there's so much politicking going on behind the scenes that they wanted an Asian, but it ended up to be Ban Ki-moon.
Right.
So anyway, Shashi, he's talented. He's very talented because, of course, he left the UN after almost, I think, three decades serving there to be a politician in India. So it's ironic he went from being in diplomacy into politics. And ironically, the book deals with kind of both sides of it.
Both elements, yeah. He's very much a polymath, isn't he, in the true sense of the
word. Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. I mean, it's ironic, you know, he is poking Britain and its empire in the eye, and yet he sounds more British than the British. So it's kind of ironic. For someone like me, also a British Indian, or India-Pakistani mix, actually, it's even more ironic that, you know, he sounds so British, and he is so British in his mannerisms, and yet, you know, the whole point is, look what they did to us. So
for anybody who isn't familiar with Shashi Tharoor or as familiar as Riz is, we have a little bit of information about him. Have a listen to this.
An author, politician and former international civil servant, Dr. Shashi Tharoor straddles several worlds of experience. He's currently a second-term Lok Sabha Member of Parliament and formerly served as Under-Secretary General at the United Nations. He's an award-winning author of 16 books of fiction and non-fiction, including Pax Indica and Inglorious Empire. Dr. Tharoor was a pioneer in using social media as an instrument of political interaction. Until 2013, he was India's most followed politician on Twitter, until being overtaken that year by the current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. He was the first Indian to reach 10,000 and 100,000 followers on the medium, and currently has 4.5 million followers.
So there you go, a little bit of information there about Shashi Tharoor, who is the author of Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India. If I sum up the book in one line, it tells the real story of the British in India, from the arrival of the East India Company to the end of the Raj, revealing how Britain's rise was built upon its plunder of India. Now, before we came on the show today, Riz, we were mentioning that there's kind of a spectrum of opinion on this. So you've got people like Neil Ferguson at one end of the spectrum, who say that the British brought democracy, the rule of law and trains to India, whatever else happened along the way. And then you've got people like Shashi, who are right at the opposite end of the spectrum. And William Dalrymple and Anita Anand, who we'll be talking about later, kind of fall somewhere three quarters of the way more towards Shashi. Where do you stand on this?
Well, you know, I have learned, being half Punjabi, half Gujarati, basically, and technically my father was born in Amritsar and his family moved to Lahore in the partition. I was born in Yemen. My mother's family, she was born in Yemen too, but they're originally from Gujarat, from Kutch, actually, the Rund of Kutch. So, and then I grew up in Britain, so I never lived in either India or Pakistan, and I left Yemen when I was four, when the Brits did. I used to say we fled with the British, now I say we strategically withdrew. But I try to be pragmatic. One thing that, you know, being a journalist at the BBC taught me was to try to see every side of the story. And try to stick with facts and figures rather than have opinions stated publicly, even if I have them myself. But I do tend to, I mean, now I'm a little freer. I'm a freelancer, so I can pretty much say what I want. It's like an ex-president, they can speak. But the thing is that I've learned India is many countries rolled into one. So in the same way, any issue surrounding India, anything from religion to the politics to its history, has many views too. So when you said, you know, Shashi's book tells the real story, it depends on which angle you look at when it comes to saying it's the real story. Mm-hmm. So Neil's perspective is one and Shashi's is another. But it is sad that traditionally, I mean, books have written it from a very romantic perspective. And I love one comment on Shashi's book said, you know, there's a tendency to see India through Western eyes, considering it as, you know, sepia fantasies. You know, this, it
yes,
is that,
yeah.
really.
Yes.
So I think it's there's a necessary adjustment. There was an issue of what was done was obviously quite oppressive. And the famines that Shashi talks about, that, you know, millions of people who died of famine because of negligence on the part of British rule.
Didn't he say 35 million?
It was about 35
was
million,
a spectacular
I think he said, yeah.
amount.
So it's
yeah.
huge. And Bangladesh, too. The Bengalis. So the thing about it is that there is more than one perspective, but I do think it's good to hear the other side now, since traditionally we've had this kind of merchant ivory production version of the Indian Raj, and we'll get onto that later because we've discussed that too. But the thing about it is that there is more than one perspective, and it's good to hear some of the not so good stories, if you like.
Speaking of different perspectives and good to hear the other side of the story, one thing that Shashi does specifically bring up in terms of the way we learn about what happened is that in A-levels and GCSE history, children aren't being taught in British curriculum the whole side of the story.
Mm-hmm. I'd say it's not even just the whole side. I'd say a lot of people come through the entire system with no knowledge whatsoever, really, about colonialism. I mean, this was all new news to me. The information about how rich India was before
right.
the Brits
yeah,
arrived,
absolutely.
I didn't know that. You
yeah.
kind of, you get indoctrinated slowly with this feeling that, oh, well, bad things may have happened, but good things were done. But actually, when you see that the condition that the country was in before and afterwards, it's fascinating, and it makes it much harder to believe the traditional mm-hmm. ways of perceiving.
And if you imagine that Britain controlled so much of the world at that time, the empire was just phenomenal in
yes.
terms of what... So, of course, you know, if you want to see them as either, you know, entitled rich, or plunder, one way or the other, Britain was going to take from the resources of its empire. And that's what's happened. And that's one of the key things, I think, that Shashi is saying, you know, that you know, reparations are required now. The trouble is, I don't think it's possible to revise history too much. I think it's important to move on, but recognize history for what it was rather than have a glorified version of it. And I think that's what's good about Shashi's book, is he's saying, look, it wasn't all kind of British bringing in railways and democracy and so on. And there is an interesting counterpoint that in the 70 years since independence, India hasn't done much. One Indian commentator wrote this lovely line saying that, that you know, perhaps the sequel to the book of, you know, Shashi's book, I should say, is, you know, disastrous democracy, what Indians did to India. You know, so it's kind of, it's an interesting follow-up.
But then there's an argument about, was that because of the way that they were left? So he gave figures
possible,
about
yeah, exactly,
illiteracy.
Exactly,
I think
yeah.
he said that, was it 80% of people couldn't read in any language whatsoever yeah. when, in 47, wasn't it, when they got freedom? And
right.
And so there's that argument too. I came out of reading everything mm-hmm. that he'd written feeling very much in kind of Shashi's boat.
No, and I can see that. I mean, actually, you know, it's very important. His perspective does fill in yeah. a lot of gaps. And as you say, it's not been something that's been taught. What's interesting is, the thing is, India is very capable. It's an amazing country. And there was, I remember reporting there one time with CNN on something, I think it was called the Hole in the Wall Project, where in a slum, a computer was put with a touch screen, you know, kind of protected glass screen, but touch screen into a slum and just left powered up. And kids could just go up and touch it and do it. And within days, they learned how to navigate the web, though it was in another language. They soon learned, you touch this, you get this, you do this, you,
yes.
do, you know. And they had no fear about, you know, like most of us starting out with computers, oh my God, if I press this button, it's going to...
Everything will go wrong.
Exactly, it will go wrong. So it's interesting. India has incredible potential and they haven't fully exploited it. And that's because... corruption, politics, it's such a big country.
Yes.
It's so easily swayed. And I know having done business in India, it's just absolutely bizarre the kind of stuff I come across.
Yeah, and I liked his argument, which was that rather than kind of reparations in terms of giving financial things back, what can Britain do to help? So he was
right.
talking about visas and letting people in, letting people
right.
study and, you know, ways of accepting what's happened and trying to make up for it without doing a kind of balance and
But it does
sheet.
Happen. I mean, look at most of the, you know, I mean, almost the whole billionaire list in,
yes.
in India, in London now is Indians.
Yes.
You know, and I got to know a lot of them either through, you know, interviewing and then became friends with them. But Lord Paul, you have people like Lord Lakshmi Mittal, all these guys, they're basically British Indians now. So Britain eventually had its colonies come home, if you like.
Yes.
In the 60s, you know, the immigration from of Indians and Pakistanis and East Africans and so on, they all started to come back. So Britain is actually a very Indian country too.
Yes, I think he was talking more about current rules and regulations,
wasn't
he?
Yeah, where it's
got
well.
A bit tighter. And,
but the connections are there. That's
yes,
what I'm
absolutely.
Getting
at. Yeah, no disagreement at all there. Another thing that I thought was interesting was the way he kind of represented Churchill, who's always, when you're taught about Churchill in England, it's always enormously patriotic. He's the hero. He saved everybody. But the kind of perspective from Shashi's point of view, in that, yes, he was doing wonderful things for Britain, arguably, but what about the people that he brought in to fight for Britain? What about the people who were taxed to pay from it? That was very interesting to me.
History tends to be kind to people. I mean, Churchill himself said, history will be kind to me, for I shall write it.
Yes.
and the thing is that history tends to be kind, even to strong leaders, irrespective of what they've done. Margaret Thatcher, I grew up in Britain through the Thatcher era, and there was, incredible. I was also in Wales. I was studying at University College Cardiff. And the miners' strikes and everything were taking place, and Arthur Scargill and everything. Neil Kinnock, who was from Penarth, just outside Cardiff, where I was actually living. Thatcher was considered evil at that time by a lot of people, especially on the left side and the unions. And now people, of course, remember her as a very strong leader who did a lot for Britain. And the same with Churchill. I mean, Churchill made tough decisions, but it's interesting now, current TV shows, The Crown and all these other programs that are coming out, are starting to revise Churchill's. Now, I haven't seen The Darkest Hour yet.
I've not seen The Crown.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Someone was just talking to me last night. My neighbour's actually talking about The Darkest Hour. I haven't seen it yet. I'm a big fan of Gary Oldman, so for me, it's great that, he's doing this. And he himself says, look, I didn't want to imitate him. I had to represent him. That was the thing. But interestingly enough, Churchill is in these series is being portrayed a little more like that kind of tough, brutal, aggressive man rather than simply the great leader. There's elements of him. Like, humanizing him, if you like, the foibles and everything else too.
There's a particular episode that I remember where he's being painted. He's having his he's having his portrait done.
Right, yeah.
And it's wonderful because they show him as a painter himself. He's quite skilled at his landscapes and whatnot. And then you have this portrait artist come in to try and do a portrait of him. And Churchill, he's getting older now. He can't stand up properly. He's got all these health problems. And he wants to be portrayed as somebody really strong and manly and young. And then when the portrait's finally done, he's not happy with it. And it just shows you that he's quite a weak man. He's flawed. He's human.
People who have a lot of power, who have a lot of influence, when it wanes, eventually they get very disgruntled. They get a lot of them get disgruntled. They get they start to reminisce about what they had and can't deal with the reality of not having it.
If you go from a world where everybody is listening to you and following everything you say to a world where you're increasingly dismissed, I can completely understand that.
Literary Spotlight.
And the book we're going to look at next is a fascinating way of seeing how one item, one jewel, can tell a history of a whole nation. And so we're going to have a look at Koh-i-Noor by William Dalrymple and Anita Anand. Riz, I know that you're more aware of these authors than I am. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, yeah, it's ironic that we have basically a white British man living in India, co-writing with an Indian woman living in Britain. Yeah,
yes.
She's a journalist. Anita's a journalist based out of Britain. She's worked on a number of channels and done a lot of work there. So, and William, of course, a very highly respected and awarded writer, Scottish, actually. And it's interesting because they chose the Koh-i-Noor. He's lived and written a lot about India as well. But they've written about the Koh-i-Noor, which is really interesting because it kind of, again, is popping up in movies. There's a sort of contemporary thing. Since The Crown and these kind of shows have come out, I saw on the flight back just now to Dubai, Victoria and Abdul, which talks about her relationship with this Indian who comes in originally to present her with a medal or something, and then ends up becoming her munchie.
Her favorite. There's a lovely bit, as you read through Koh-i-Noor, there's a lovely bit where Daleep Singh moves into the court becomes her favorite there as well. And the beginning, that's a very good relationship, and she's very kind and supportive.
It's tragic, though. The whole story around the diamond is tragic because, something I didn't realize, that before 1725, all diamonds came out of India.
Yes, until they discovered Brazilian mines. Yeah, it was new news to me.
So,
it was fascinating.
And also, the diamond represented something different, was something different in terms of its representation. It had a more kind of spiritual, cultural, religious kind of centerpiece in Indian law and culture. And so it seems that everyone who handled the Koh-i Noor went through some kind of horrible tragedy.
The violence in this book,
awful,
I mean, if you were looking for like an 18 register book, the things that happened, the blindings, yeah. the terrible things.
And so much blinding.
So much yeah. blinding. And also, do you watch Game of Thrones?
There's the
bit where Khal Drogo puts that, was it silver that he poured all over?
I think he pours gold on his head. I'll give you a crown, and he pours the metal over his head.
That's kind of come from history, that's basically part of when they were trying to torture one of the owners of the Koh-i-Noor to give up its existence. It's shocking.
And it's awful because if you think about it, it started out in this, with Shah Jahan's, peacock throne. It's a centerpiece in there. Yeah, it's pulled out of there. It's been, wrapped on armbands and carried around by, Afghans and Persians. And it's just shifted around everywhere. And it was only when Ranjit Singh, got it, that it really started to become something significant. He built his empire.
Yes, it meant a lot symbolically to him, didn't it, as he was kind of trying to reclaim his empire. And
so the thing about it is that it went through this horrible thing, and Daleep Singh's entry to the British court also kind of was his spiral downhill, because he became a Christian, he joined the court, he was favourite for a while, then he fell out, then he wanted to go back to India and try and reclaim Punjab. His mother had been exiled to Nepal.
The treatment of his mother is appalling.
And then he reconnected with her, but then he came back to Britain with her.
Yes.
And then blew all the money he had. And everything was just kind of, and the Queen rejected him and society rejected him.
And died in poverty in Paris, didn't he? It's a really sad story.
So it's ironic. Ill-fated duel, actually. It's the story around, whoever handled
it. Then there's that kind of, the kind of myth now is that it's okay if you're a female. You can have it on the women's crown. So it was the Queen Mother's.
But the Queen, apparently, Queen Elizabeth II, has never worn it.
I think she fears it.
Yeah, which is almost ironic.
That's quite interesting.
And in this film I saw, I was telling you, Victoria and Abdul, she talks about the Koh-i-Noor, and they talk about, she talks about, I have the Koh-i-Noor, So it is interesting. It is one of those ill-fated jewels, mystery surrounds it and tragedy surrounds it too.
Yes, yeah, and that kind of adds to its allure somehow, doesn't it?
I'm going to be curious talking to William when he comes to the festival, about that, what drew him into that particular story.
He wrote all the kind of first half, which is the kind of past history, isn't it? And Anita kind of takes over when it is taken to England and all that kind of element. So he was really in the proper brutal part of the history.
And I do find it fascinating because, again, he has the perspective from in the country, though he's, of British origin. And then she's writing it from an Indian outside, the expat.
Yes.
So it is kind of ironic they have that perspective on it too.
It's very interesting. And it's what was particularly interesting is the way that the media was almost used to build up its allure, especially when it came over. And then I loved the bit in the book about the Great Exhibition. Yeah. And everyone came and everyone was just really disappointed.
Yeah.
So it was set up in the middle of this huge space. And literally all it was just one little piece of rock. And so all the people kind of came to look at it, wandered off disappointed. And they kept trying to make it more and more exciting. Right. Nothing worked. It was Prince Albert, wasn't it?
And the irony is that, again, it's now become symbolic. So the whole fight over the Koh-i-Noor is become so symbolic. And remember in 2010, David Cameron, I remember actually his comment when he said, they said we should have given it back. And he said, well, if we did, the British Museum would be empty.
Yes,
<That's right.
laughs> I like that. And the Taliban put in their claim for it as well.
Brilliant. Again, it was worn around, on an armband around Afghanistan for an hour long before.
Not Nadir Shah,
it was the...
His bodyguard,
yes, right.
Abdul.
The bodyguard, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
Terrible at names. I've
forgotten that one too, but yeah, that's right. He took it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8, and we're talking about Koh-i-Noor, the history of the most infamous diamond by Anita Anand and William Dalrymple. William Dalrymple is attending the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, which is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March, and tickets are already on sale at emiratelitfest.com if you're interested in the topic. If you'd like to win a copy, you have the chance to do that, so you just have to answer the following question. The Koh-i-Noor diamond is currently in which building in England? Text in the answer with your name to 4001. Remember, do text in with your name to 4001, because if you don't, then we just give you random literary names. We've had a lovely text message come in saying, hi guys, today India and Britain have a great relationship despite of all the obnoxious things British invaders did to India and to many other countries around, which is an absolute shame for any country to do. Hope Britain and the world learn not to destroy other countries ever again. Because you haven't sent in your name, I'm just going to call you Batman. So that's what Batman has to say. He's texted to Talking of Books. Sorry, Rachel, one of the things that you mentioned a while ago when we were talking about this off air was that it's ironic that a history story about a piece of jewellery involves so many men.
Yes, I find it fascinating. Yeah. Before I go into that, can I just give the correct names of people? Because
yes,
I hate
please
being
do
ignorant. It was Ahmad Khan Abdali,
that's
who
right
was the bodyguard, Nadashan's
right
bodyguard.
He's the
and he's the one that took
yeah
it through to Afghanistan. And this was at the stage where they were all wearing it on their armbands
arms,
everywhere
right
to
yeah
show that
right
they were the leader. And yet I found it fascinating because there are loads of side characters in this book almost, and they're all the females, whereas there are some really interesting women.
Right.
There's a bit where you've got... hang on, I've got to get their names right again. You've got... Where's her name?
We're just going to call her Batgirl if you can't.
Yeah, that's what we're going to have to do in a minute. But yes, yeah, so you had basically you had all the wives and all of the harem women that are all kind of fighting to keep the diamonds out, but they're all kind of signed off a bit. And then you had Wafa Begum, who was the wife of Shah Shuji, who had to keep it safe while people were trying to prize it from her. And then you had the mother of Dilip Singh, which was the saddest story
right,
in
yeah
a way,
yeah,
in that she was a very intelligent woman trying to protect her son.
Oh, he's 10 years old when they were
he was 10,
signed,
yeah, and he was taken away from him when he was 9.
Yeah.
And she was the only one that spotted what the British were arguably trying to do.
Right.
Because they would get him to sign all these treaties.
That's right, yeah.
Dishonest
absolutely
treaties.
Yeah.
And then make amendments all the way through. And so he signed away everything. And she was sent off into penury, locked up, not
yeah
allowed to see her son. Terrible story.
No, actually, you're right. I mean, it's, you know, it, obviously, it was very male-dominated. A lot of the...
Years,
yeah, which, well, largely, it was around the sword. You know, it was brutal. So it was largely the men who were out fighting. That's why I think it is. It's ironic, though, yeah, because it is about jewellery. Which is even
yes,
more
that's
ironic
what I found interesting.
Although you could argue that sort of hip hop and rap culture has brought bling back onto men,
yes,
and I think they wear more jewelry than the women.
Yeah.
But no, it is. It's again, it's just a tragic story. It's just
yes
really, you know.
There's a great bit about the other thing is that as well as Kohinoor, there were these other diamonds, all from the same source,
that's
but
right,
they've
yeah
kind of faded into
yeah
insignificance. And one of them, which I think was it the Great Mughal diamond, but the one that Catherine the Great was given. And again, this was where the women slightly got a bit of power. I think if you're a queen or an empress, then you're fine.
Mm.
But she said she wanted the diamond. Her admirer spent all of his money getting the diamond for her. And by the time he returned, because he'd been doing it for so long, she'd found someone else to replace him.
Right.
And he died in a lunatic asylum because he'd ruined himself, and she just took the diamond, stuck it in her scepter, and that was it.
Yeah. No, it is. It's funny, you know, because these things that become symbolic like that, you know, define history.
Yes.
And even though, again, the reality is maybe they're not that special, the story that's woven around them is really what determines how special
yeah
they become.
History. Yes.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is ironic there that you have that.
And the fact that Prince Albert basically had half the diamond chopped off in order
yeah
to make it look acceptable to kind of European eyes and give it that brilliant cut
okay,
that it didn't
yeah
have before.
But this is also the strange thing is that, you know, a story that centres around where it ends up, what it is, you know, has been documented more than, I mean, we talk more about the Kohinoor, for example, in history and books and stuff, than perhaps the bad side of India, you know, the Indian occupation, if you like, of
yes,
colonial
people know
powers
more about the
and
diamond.
That's, yeah,
than,
so it is
yes,
ironic.
So
that's, we talk about the British
this
Raj, you can talk about the diamond, but then, oh, wait a minute, you mean there was starvation? There was millions?
Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah.
It's very true.
So there you go. That is, what's the full title of the book? So it's Kohinoor, and
it's,
then what's
Kohinoor,
the subtitle?
The History of the World's Most Infamous Diamond,
yeah,
and it's by William Dalrymple and Anita Anand, and published by Bloomsbury.
Yeah.
Bloomsbury. Excellent pronunciation
yes
of Bloomsbury.
Yeah.
Bloomsbury, yeah.
Lots of correct text messages coming in to win a copy of that book. Well done, everybody. Obviously, I'm not going to give it away now, because I do that sometimes. if you would like to win a copy of Kohinoor, you haven't texted in yet, all you have to do is answer the following question. The Kohinoor diamond is currently in which building in England? And you text that into 4001 or use the Dubai iMessage app. Please include your name, otherwise we will call you Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, or Batman, or any other character from anything remotely literary.
Now regarded by many as the world authority on Indian food, Madhur Jaffrey is an award-winning actress and best-selling cookery author. Her first book, An Invitation to Indian Cookery, was published in 1973, and her series for BBC television, Madhur Jaffrey's Indian Cookery, made her household name. She's appeared in more than 20 films, including Merchant Ivory's Heat and Dust, and written over 15 cookery books, including Madhur Jaffrey's Ultimate Curry Bible, which was published by Ebury Press.
So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Dubai Eye talking of books, and we're here talking about our literary spotlight on India with Riz Khan. If you haven't heard already, he's international journalist, author, and public speaker known worldwide for his TV shows on CNN International and Al Jazeera English. But you were telling us you started out on radio.
I did. I started at the BBC. In fact, I co-presented the very first the launch program, the launch news show on BBC World Service News TV when we launched it in November 91 with Pam Armstrong, who had been recruited from ITN. And we were like the Dirty Dozen. We'd launched it. But then I left a year and a half later because CNN offered me a job. And my boss at the BBC was the one who said, go off on that adventure, because so I wasn't going to go.
Not only is your radio stint today a blast from the past, but the lady we were just listening to there, listening to her little biography, she's attending the Dubai Lit Fest. You're interviewing her at the Literature mm-hmm. Festival. And you've interviewed her before, haven't you?
I have. She's really lovely. Madhura Jaffrey, it's the irony, you know, that she got known for her cooking. And she also thought this was quite funny, that she got known for her cooking, when actually she said, look, I'm an actress. That's what I did, you know. And she was kind of credited with getting Ismail Merchant and James Ivory together to form that Merchant Ivory Productions team, which was very successful. And if I remember correctly, we talked a lot about the difference between a chef and a cook. Because she said, I'm a cook, I'm not a chef. And it's ironic because I cook a lot. And for me, you know, cooking is actually a big part of my life. And I'm really into using spices and so on. And in fact, you know, whenever I've sort of built a home, I've put a very powerful industrial extractor so that the house doesn't get filled with the smells of the food. And the interesting thing is, she said, look, you know, cooks work differently from chefs. And I also know this with someone who cooks as opposed to baking. I can't bake. I can't sit there and measure stuff out. I do things with a pinch of this, a tip of this, and I can go. And I actually go a lot by smell. Which is actually a problem when you have a powerful extractor, because I have to kind of lean down into the food. The thing is that she said, you know, I'm a cook. That's what I primarily, do. And she's brilliant because she managed to obviously popularize Indian cooking by keeping the books very simplistic. And it's interesting because her initial taste, you know, from the part of India where she was, it was very kind of the northern cuisine, which is actually kind of simpler food. You know, if you like, even Punjabi cooking, it tends to be kind of a lot of butter, a lot of carbs, a lot of meat. Whereas you go south, it's totally different. It's very light, watery. There's a lot more humidity and so on there. So whenever I go to the south of India, I go to somewhere like Chennai, it's all these like, you know, soupy dals and things like this. And the food is very different. And it's balanced for body chemistry more. In the north, it's all about getting the calories, and because it does get cold
energy,
in the winter,
yeah.
You know, and about energy, yeah. And eating meat and getting angry and fighting. In the south, it's, oh, I've just had a dal, let me paint something. Or compose some music. All the art and the music comes from the south. I mean, it's
nice.
Amazing.
Whenever I read about Madhura Jaffrey or I hear anything about her, she always strikes me as a rather remarkable woman. And that's because of everything that she's done. She's done acting, she's done cooking, she's done it all. But I love the fact how it all began, that her mother taught her via a correspondence course when she was at drama school. So she gets to the UK and apparently she can't find a decent curry anywhere.
That's
and
it.
She's missing the taste of home. So she writes to her mother, and her mother sends her basically a cookery correspondence course is what she embarks on while she's doing her drama studies in the UK. And just to think that the journey began via correspondence with her mum because she was missing home.
And disappointment with blancmange.
That's right, yeah, it's how bland it is. It sounds bad as well. I mean,
horrible.
It's been years since I tried blancmange, but I remember
it. Since I was a child. Disgusting
Same
stuff.
Thing, yeah. Yeah. No, but actually it is interesting because, she did that. She said the cooking came by accident in that respect, you know,
necessity,
because she wanted
almost.
To eat well.
Yeah.
And I had the same thing when I went to university. I said to my mother, teach me some, you know, mixing some basic spices, creating this dadka, you know, this base, spice base. And that's how a lot of people learn. And each family has their own version. I have two or three male friends who are great cooks. And I just watched, you know, they use different. One friend uses a lot more turmeric, for example, than I do. I like cumin a lot and, you know, using some of the garam masala, depending on what I'm cooking. So it is interesting. And so, yeah, she did that. And it's interesting also because in New York, I was moderating at a human rights meeting. And there was a very prominent English lawyer. I can't remember his name, but he's Sir someone or the other. Anyway, very English, though he looked like he was mixed blood, actually. It was interesting. And he's got, you know, all kinds of royalty in the family somewhere. But he said to me, would you like to go for dinner this evening? And I said, sure. He said, I know this wonderful restaurant. Now, we got to the restaurant. I realized it was Mother Jaffrey's restaurant, and it was one I used to go to regularly when I was in New York, because there's some I like, some I don't, some of them, you know. But anyways, great food. And we went up there on the Upper East Side, and he said, I like coming here because it's one of the few places I can find Cornish hen.
Cornish hen.
It's quite funny. That's what he wanted.
So just to remind you, if you're listening earlier, we were having a little chat about Koh-i-Noor, the history of the world's most infamous diamond by Anita Anand and William Dalrymple. Did I get the title of that right?
You did.
Yes.
Fantastic. If you'd like to win a copy, you just have to answer the following question. People are sending in lots of text messages. Some of them are incorrect, some of them are right, but a lot of people are getting it right, which is great. The Koh-i-Noor diamond is currently in which building in England? Text in the answer with your name to 4001. We'll be announcing the winners at the end of the show, so do stay tuned for that. What was the most memorable moment, Riz? Because we're currently talking about Madhur Jaffrey, or Madhur Jaffrey. I've been corrected on my pronunciation a couple of times. What was the most memorable part of the interview?
You know, I like the fact she's very down to earth. One of the things I tried to do in the series One-on-One, for example, where I talked about people's life stories, it had a kind of loose structure, starting out with, you know, what was driving them now, what was their kind of philosophy and what they were doing. Then it went on to childhood and upbringing. Then defining moments, and then kind of legacy, you know, future projects and legacy. What I like about her, she was really incredibly down to earth, very warm person, and very honest about, you know, herself. It was like, you know, this is what I am. I did this by accident, or this happened by accident, and you know, she was quite self-effacing, and I like that about her. And the thing about it, I mean, she's, you know, getting on. She's just still got so much energy. It's ironic, actually, because the Queen will have to write her a letter in about 15 years. She'll get a letter from the Queen. Anyway, I wish her a long life. So she was very down to earth, and I like that because there was a wide range of guests that I had over that four-year span that I did. That was about 200 interviews, obviously, 200, and, yeah, it was weekly. So some of them were just, you know, difficult to connect with at a personal level. Ben Kingsley, for example, Sir Ben Kingsley, he's half Indian. He's the one, ironic, the story around him getting selected to do Gandhi and everything else was interesting. But I never felt I met the real man. And it's interesting because my opening question or statement to him was, you know, I've been terrified of you ever since I saw Sexy Beast. You remember this movie, yeah. Very violent, he plays
very
a thug.
Scary.
And straight away he said, yeah, Don Logan. And he was this character. With Madhur Jaffrey, I felt I got the real person all the way through, and that was really nice. You know, there was no wall, there was no face, you know, for the camera or for, you know, the interview. So she's a very warm, and she was, you know, again, discussing food was really great with her because, you know, it's for me, it's a personal interest and pleasure. So it's fantastic. I'm really glad she's coming to the festival. She's doing the food evening, isn't she? So.
Yeah, and you get the chance to talk to her
there
again.
You go, exactly.
Which is great. Riz, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm really sad about this, but unfortunately, that is the way radio works.
Thank you for
having
me on.
I'm going to have to kick you off. But thank you so much for joining us for Literary Spotlight today. It's been an absolute pleasure. We look forward to seeing you at the festival. For anybody listening wondering how they can get involved in the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature and see these authors, William Dalrymple, Shashi Tharoor and Madhur Jaffrey, to mention but a few of the over 180 authors who are attending. You can go to emiratelitfest.com for more information. The festival is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March at the Intercontinental Hotel in Dubai Festival City. Somebody has texted in to say, any events for budding writers at Emirates Lit Fest? Because you haven't put your name on that text message, I'm going to say that's Jane Austen texting in asking for advice about events for budding writers at Emirates Lit Fest. If you go online to emiratelitfest.com, you can look at all the workshops available. There's something for everybody in there. There's a masterclass with Alexander McCall Smith, which is incredible. If you manage to get your hands on a ticket to that, I would thoroughly recommend it. There's a lot more on there as well. So do check out the website.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.